So you're in Madrid. Is that where you guys are right now?
Yeah. Do a show here tomorrow night. All our Spain shows are sold out, so should be pretty good.
Yeah. It looks fantastic from what I've been seeing on all the posts, all your shows. Been great turnouts.
Yeah, it's been great.
That's
Very
gonna be
nice.
that's gotta be a great feeling. Yeah. How is Eric doing with the voice? Was that just a temporary thing?
I don't know. we hired a guy to help him with the heavy lifting, and he sounds great, so should be okay, I
So it's
guess.
going well. Okay. And today is a day off for you or travel day?
Well, it's for me, a day off is a day when you wake up in the morning and you spend the whole day, go to bed and wake up the next morning and you didn't do anything. But so it's a travel day mostly. They call it a day off, but really, we're traveling. So, and there's not no show, but we took us about, oh man, we got in about four. So we traveled for 16 or 18 hours.
Wow. On bus.
Yeah, tour bus. But it's a great bus. These German buses we hire, they're fantastic. And the drivers are right on and they're clean and comfortable. And it's I would take a 48-hour bus ride over a half-hour flight any day.
Right. I hear nightmares about the airlines right now.
Yeah, they're just awful.
So here we are, Mr. Big, on the farewell tour. It's the big finish tour, right? That's what we're calling it. It's got to be a little bittersweet for you.
Well, it's not as much bitter. We had a great run, and we're enjoying this. And when it's done, it's done, and we made our mark. We did what we set out to do, and had incredible success around the world. So I'm quite pleased with our body of work. I think it was, and I think it's evidenced by the attendance at the shows and the enthusiasm at the shows. It's very nice.
And when does this tour run through?
Think August. I think they were looking at a few other territories that we haven't hit, but I haven't seen any confirmation on any of that yet. So as far as I know, it's August. We have kind of a big break at starting about June 7th, and then we go back to it in August.
Okay. And you have, Nick is playing drums for you guys right now, right? Filling in on the
Sure
tour.
is,
Yeah.
amazingly.
And that's going well.
He's awesome. We love him. He sings great and plays great, and he's a joy to work with. And he fits exactly the part. He's just been a just an incredible asset. Really wonderful.
Well, let's go back a little bit, before we get into some more Mr. Big. Let's talk about, back in your Talis days a little bit. Now you guys, what do you think held Talis back? Because you guys were did very well regionally, right? But just couldn't get to that next level.
Well, at the very end, we did get a deal. Gold Mountain Records, that was Danny Goldberg. He ended up managing Nirvana years later. Quite a serious powerhouse in the music biz. We got signed to the William Morris Agency, and things were going well for us, but I got the offer to go to California with Dave Roth. So I'm not sure how it would have played out if we would have just if I would have just stuck with Talis. But at that point, I've been pounding on it for so long, I just thought, I'll take what's behind door number three, and took the trip out to LA instead. And I think it was a better move for me. But in the early days, yeah, Talis was we had a lot of talent in the band. There's been about nine versions of Talis. The three-piece version was popular, and then that four-piece version with Mark Miller and Phil Nero and two different guitar players was probably equally as popular because we traveled more. But that's arguable, of course. But Yeah, the three piece, it was comfortable to play in that band because it was just go out every weekend and places would be packed and we'd play, and there wasn't a lot of motivation to go further. I felt like I was trying to get that to happen. I may have misperceived it, but that wasn't the same with all the other members, you know. And we can say, yeah, I want to make it big someday, but unless you do something about it, you know. So I had we reformed after the two of the three quit, and with Mark Miller, who was just a powerhouse, and Phil Narrell, and was looking really good. But as I said, I think when the time came for me to have that opportunity to go out to L.A. with David Lee Roth, I took it. So
yeah, that was a huge opportunity right there. And you met Dave when you guys opened for Van Halen, right?
Yeah, I didn't know him that much. I knew Eddie and spoke with him on the phone many times. And he was a great source of encouragement for me. That's why his death was pretty crushing, because he was the guy. I knew he'd always take my call and always had something positive to say. And we talked about playing together many times. So, I didn't know Dave as well, but then he contacted me on that summer of 85.
Right, right. And I've heard you said that he said there was a movie out there. Is that how that went? He wanted you to come out for a movie?
Yeah. It was kind of a cover story, but there really was a movie.
What was the movie?
Out there. What's that?
What was it? What did it ever happen? The movie?
I got the script.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it never happened. If it would have happened, I think people would have known about it. But no, it never happened. No, CBS Pictures decided to pull the funding and they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. So you're out there with Dave, and it was just you and him at first, correct? And then you helped form that band?
Yeah. And we hung out a bit, got to know each other a bit, and then we needed a guitar player, so I suggested Steve Vai. He already spoke with Steve Stevens, who's a wonderful player, but Steve was involved with Billy Idol and didn't really want to leave that. I think he was correct in doing so. So I told Dave I know another Steve. Steve came in. Steve and I went and found Greg Vicinet. And I've told the story about 10 billion times.
I know. I've seen that. 20 billion. Yeah.
And print on video. It's amazing. But, so.
Yeah. Well, that was a moment that really put you into the made you a household name, was with that band, pretty much. That's when it all started for you, right?
Well, it depends on how you define that. I'd already gotten toured with UFO.
Mm-hmm.
Been in major magazines and everything. Nowhere near the amount of coverage I got when I got with Dave, of course, no doubt about that. You know, it wasn't like I was, doing landscaping or working at a bird.
Right.
And Talos was doing great business all over the country. Mm-hmm. We went on tour with Yngwie and it was amazing. Sold out shows everywhere. So it wasn't like I was some poor, decrepit loser checking garbage cans for a half a Coke. You know, I was doing okay.
Yeah. Eat 'em and Smile, that was my second concert ever. My first was Van Halen on the 5150 tour, and then second was Eat 'em and Smile when I got to see you on that tour. And that was probably my favorite concert I've been to.
Oh, it's good to hear. Thanks.
Yeah, you guys were so much fun. I mean, was it as much fun being in that band as it appeared to be?
At that time, yes. Absolutely. At that time, yes. Things changed later on, and I left. It was not a good scene for me, so I took off and started Mr. Big.
Right, right. When you did leave, I mean, you recorded the album. Were you just not into it the whole time you were recording it? I mean, what happened?
Well, Eat 'em and Smile, we're all together in a room, we're playing together, it's cool, jamming, playing, having a riot, having fun. Skyscraper was, one guy would come in to the studio to play the pre-recorded tracks that we already had, No, there was, we'd never, I don't think I saw the other guys during the entire recording, Steve or Greg. They went and did all the drums. They put them all into a microscope and, you know, spent a whole day, a half dB increase on the hi-hat, another whole day, a half dB decrease on the hi. It's just insanity. It's just it was insane. And it's just not how you make a rock record. You go in and bash it out. And
yeah,
that's why Eat 'Em and Smile worked. So it was a complete change of atmosphere. And I knew it wasn't going to work for me.
Yeah, yeah. Why did it change? Was it just Dave just wanting to try something new? Or, I mean, what changed?
Well, I think he was surrounded by people that were telling him things that they shouldn't have been telling him. And that happens a lot with an artist. They get surrounded by people. And those people start to weave their way into decision-making. And as a result, some horrible decisions are made. And I think that's what it was.
So then you left Dave in what? Was it 88 maybe?
87.
87. Yeah, okay. And then Mr. Big's first record came out in 89.
The Mr. Big record?
Yeah, your first one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was quick. We went in, we had songs, pieces of songs. We got together. Me, Pat, and Paul would get together, rehearse in L.A., send tapes up to Eric. He'd write lyrics, really great, sang his ass off. We went in, we recorded that thing quick, easy, and all real. Addicted to that rush. I think that was pretty much a first take. Could have been.
Really?
So that's the way, for me, that's the way you'd make a record. That's the way you make a band sound like a band. Putting everything on a microscope is maybe for something else. After rock.
Yeah. Now, when you were searching for members for Mr. Big, were those guys your first choices?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay.
We, I knew Pat, had seen him play. I knew Paul used to come out to see me play when we played in Pittsburgh, when he lived there. He was very much younger. And I met him, talked with him a couple times in LA also. And then we're looking for singers. And then Mike Varney sent me a tape of Eric Martin. Actually played it for me over the phone. So that's exactly what I'm looking for. So we got together, and it was pretty quick and easy. And we got the stroke of luck is that Herbie Herbert decided to manage the band. Mm-hmm. And he had been involved with Eric at one point in his career. So having him as our manager was the golden touch, because he was the man.
So when you guys got together to write songs, did you already have a lot of these songs together, or at least the ideas for them, or was it all a collaboration together?
Parts. We would sit down and Paul would play a lick and what key is that in? Okay. And Pat would do a beat and we come up, chorus or pre-chorus. What do you think? Let's do this. And we would just put them together like that. All of the first four records were put together like that, identically.
Right. That's fun. That's fun that way. Addicted to That Rush was the first single off that album, if I recall. And it did okay over here, but you guys got really big in Japan, right? Right away?
We did well in foreign markets. It wasn't just Japan. Huh. We played in front of 100,000 people on Santos Beach outside of Sao Paulo, Brazil. We had amazing success in all of Southeast Asia, because Japan is Japan. It's completely different than Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Taiwan, China. Those are all completely different worlds. So when you get one, it doesn't automatically mean you get the others. And we went and played hard, and we did great all over there. So, and the USA was soft at the time because so many records were being released. So we got kind of lost in the shuffle. Most of those died out. And then we put our second record out. We were able to get attention and get a hit single.
Yeah. How did that change your life? Because that really put you guys up there.
Well, it changed everything. We had already toured quite a bit. Of course, our manager, Herbie Herbert, got us on the Rush tour. Again, we were on it on the first album. And so we were playing to a lot of people with a big hit record. It was quite amazing. Everything changed. I remember, you know, getting royalty checks in the mail and wondering, because you'd get a check for like $11 sometimes, right, or less. And so I remember getting one from our business management. Hey, let's see how we're doing. And holy cow. Jeepers creepers. Quite amazing. Pardon the siren.
Yeah, you okay out there? You're in a good area?
Yeah. It's a beautiful. Madrid is very nice.
Yeah.
So probably slipped and spilled their coffee. But anyway, yeah, it was quite a change. And we, Japan was one of the first ones to really go very strongly behind the band. But we were number one in Germany, number one in 14 countries, and gold and platinum all over the place in different territories. So it was quite a great thing. I urge everyone to have a hit single someday. Because
we all wish, man, right? We all wish that could happen.
Yeah. And and some people said, oh, you must be bummed out that your hit single was an acoustic sign. Are you kidding me? I'm so happy.
Yeah.
And I love that song. Anyway, when the song was presented to us by Eric, he wasn't that hot on it. And me, Paul, and Pat said, we got to do this song. Come on, it's great. We got to do it. So we did.
I wonder what he wasn't digging, what Eric wasn't liking about it.
Well, he writes a lot of songs, so he's got a lot to pick from, but we only heard a small sampling of them. So, oh, that one there, you know. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he realized very soon that it was the right thing to do, of course. Mm-hmm.
Well, Lean Into It was a great album. That's probably my favorite Mr. Big album. Although, I've been getting into the later ones in the recent, I'd say, year. I've been starting to listen to the later albums, and those are all really good. Have some great songs on them too.
Yeah, Bump Ahead and Hey Man got some great stuff on it. There's a song called Promise or the Moon, which should have been just monstrous. But at that time, the whole Nirvana grunge thing happened, and most rock bands fell out of favor in the USA. But overseas, I remember Japan, they're like, why is everybody dressing in old clothes and not shaving? What's wrong with that? Why do they look so unhappy? So we continued to develop foreign markets because grunge didn't really go over outside of America like it did inside America.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we would go to Indonesia and play in front of thousands and thousands of people and huge festivals in South America, just insane business. And Europe as well, though some of the grunge movement made its way over there. At one point, there was like five Mr. Big copy bands in Italy. You know, they're
really
playing our stuff, yeah.
Were they playing it correctly?
I've heard some of them, and they're actually pretty good.
Yeah,
pretty good.
I was messing around with Addicted to That Rush, just the beginning, just the little tapping beginning part. And yeah. I can't get your speed. I'm not big on the, I'm not good at the tapping.
Probably, that's a double thing happening.
I know. Mm-hmm.
So your finger never goes faster than it would normal speed, but when you double it up.
I got to practice it. And what started happening is my finger was getting tender.
You build your calluses up.
It hurts, yeah. Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, I always go by the idea that there's nothing I do that someone else can't do. It's just going to take some time.
Yeah, well, in my case, a lot of time. But so you guys are playing Lean Into It in its entirety on this tour. What was the decision behind that?
Well, we just thought that was our most popular record and the one that gave us our hit. So, and a lot of the songs we hadn't played live, we didn't... I don't know if we ever played Never Say Never or Lucky This Time. And also My Kind of Woman. I don't think we played those much live. I don't know why at the time. I think we just, if you've got 10 songs to pick from, pick as many as you can. And sometimes some get left behind. So we just thought doing the entire record would finally bring those songs into a live performance. And also doing a record in sequence kind of says a little bit of a tribute to how we used to listen to records. We put it on side one, listen to the whole side one, flip it over side two, and then repeat. So there was a sequence to them that was during those days. It was not, it's not as important now, of course, but people of my generation and younger, you know, they're generally did that. Yeah. So we thought it'd be nice to do that whole record in sequence during the show. And it's been, people have been very pleased with that. So I'm happy to say.
Yeah, sequencing is very important, I think. You've been, or do you have a big input on that? Because all of your records that you're on, the Winery Dogs, you know, everything, it, they all seem to flow great.
Yeah, I we used to, the earlier Mr. Big Records, I kind of stepped back from it, sequencing as a, but it, there is an art to it. Because, and again, because not so many people listen in sequence anymore. They listen to that one song and they never download the others, you know? So that's why it's a little bit different. So I'm not as involved in it as I used to, but the first two or three, maybe four Mr. Big Records, I think I sequenced them. And for me, I'm a live player from the beginning. So I'm looking at it like a live set. And a lot of bands would sequence a record like that. Open up with a bang, another good one. Let's pull it back a bit, another bang. Now let's get to the ballad. Then let's come and end on a high point. And, you know, that's how you would do a live show. So record sequencing was done like that. But if you're not going to listen in sequence, that doesn't necessarily work.
Yeah. How do you feel about that, how music's listened to today a lot of times?
Well, it's just different. You know, as you get older, a next generation comes along and does things different, and all the old people complain that that's not how we did it and that's not the right way. But, you know, that's kind of standard. But things evolve and change, and there'll become a time when people look back and say, remember when people used to, like, just download one song? Oh, that was ridiculous. How stupid, you know? It'll always change. And generation to generation. So I'm not opposed to, as long as they're listening, I think it's good. And music is available everywhere now. On my phone, I can access anything. I find some oddball, obscure bootleg track by Hendrix. Found it. I found it on YouTube. You can find it anywhere. So that's it balances out. I've got a hard drive with my iTunes collection, and it's about, 2.4 terabytes now of all music that I've collected. I ripped all of my CDs that I'd collected since CDs started, and just got tons and tons and tons of music. And I have a little hard drive, I plug it into my laptop or access it through my iPhone, and everything I've ever wanted is there. So there's advantages to it as well.
Yeah. Is that bass, that's your, what's it, Attitude?
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Okay.
It's basically similar to my old P bass in that it's got two outputs. One's for this pickup and one's for that pickup. And on my original P bass, I installed a Gibson EBO pickup by the neck, because the Gibson pickups generally were by the neck and they're big fat chrome thing, super deep and bassy. The P bass pickup sounds great, and probably the most widely used and recorded pickup ever for bass, by far. But the low end on the EBO was really something spectacular. So you use both of them, and it's great. Use both of them through two amps, and it's even better. So that was the principle behind the bass. And my P bass had a 68 Telecaster neck on it, which was big and fat and beautiful. So we modeled this neck after that Tele neck. And so most of the things that I did on my own, very poor craftsmanship on my P bass, were done on this correctly. So that quality version of it. And I've been using these now for, I've got to clarify facts of this, but I might be the longest guy who's played his signature bass, signature instrument, and endorsed the company that the same company that makes it. I got someone told me that, but I didn't get all the details straight. But I've been with them since '84, so that's a long time.
And you use that in the studio and live?
Yeah. Yeah, once in a while in the studio, I'll use a variation of this with the True Temperament frets. And they're frets that aren't straight. They're squiggly because they make sure that every note is exactly in tune. And that would require a fret that was not straight. So, and they're various shapes as they go up and down. And it's subtle. You don't really notice it right away. But it's good when I'm playing with keyboards, because keyboards are more in tune than fretted instruments. Sometimes I'll use that. If I need a super deep low bass, I'll use one of these tuned, a restrung and tuned B-E-A-D. Or there's also a six-string bass that I used on the song, Just Take My Heart, on off Lean Into It. But live, I've always played that on four-string. So, but generally one of these.
Okay. You don't do a lot of five string, right?
None at all. I don't own one. I think you're going to go from multiple strings, go to six.
Right to six. Yeah.
You know, so let's go. We're going to let's dive right in the deep end.
Yeah.
And like I said, I use a four string. I had a double neck I use live on this tour, and one string is tuned B, one neck is tuned B E A D, the other standard E flat, because we had to change some keys around on some of the songs. So I'd be putting a bass down, picking one up, putting it down, picking it up like crazy. So I just let me just use the double neck. One's tuned to most of the songs, and the other's tuned to the rest of them. So
I see. Now live, you guys, you know, the big thing lately has been backing tracks and stuff, but you guys are just totally live, right?
Absolutely. Always have been, always will be.
Uh-huh.
I did a tour with a Japanese band that used backing tracks. Not to supplant lack of ability to do it, but they just had some rather adventurous orchestration that they needed. Mm-hmm. Then I did a tour with Tony McAlpine and Virgil Donati. And we had also three of us, and there was a lot of stuff. So Virgil would start the song. We had tracks. No, and there was no vocals in any of the songs. It was just all instrumental. Mm-hmm. So it was okay, but I'd rather hire real people and really play.
Mm-hmm.
Or just do more so that you make up for the lack of people. You know, it's more real to me.
Yeah. And you play in a lot of three piece, not double guitar bands, and you prefer that, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm a big fan of like Grand Funk, ZZ Top and Cream. And then so many bands that had three piece with lead singer, guitar, bass, drums, lead singer, Zeppelin, The Who, and some of the greatest bands ever. But it requires me, and it did from the early days, to do more to fill up for the lack of keyboards or second guitar or horn section or whatever else you might have to do. So that was a challenge, but it was also a freedom. So I could do a lot more. And I remember one guitar player I played with years ago, we were gigging every night, and he went out and jammed with another band one night that was guitar, bass, and drums. And he hated it because he said there was holes you could drive a truck through, you know, that he felt like he had to start playing like way more just to make up for the fact that the bass player was a simpler player, which people often misunderstand. I believe when a simpler player plays, that it's not any less awesome than a player who's playing more. Cliff Williams from AC/DC is one of my favorite players of all time. He's so great. That band is the greatest rock band ever. And some guys that just play very simple, it's wonderful. And sometimes a little thing develops where some people think that guys who play way more must look down. That's not true at all. I look up to them and cherish them, you know. But then again, these days musicians are just kind of looking for things to argue about online, so it's hard to avoid.
You stay out of that. You've always been out of the drama, though. I don't recall like ever hearing about Mr. Big, you know, doing anything, you know, that got him in the news for something awful.
No, we're about Music, really. Our manager Herbie one time told the story. We were playing some arena opening for Rush, I think, and he was out to see us. And I'm there practicing. Paul's there practicing. Pat's there. And he said, "You know, I've stood here for 10 minutes and none of you guys even looked up." He thought that was cool that we were so concerned with getting it right and doing better and all those things that we didn't concern ourselves with it. In high school, I smoked dope a couple times. But that was it. I stopped in 1971. I haven't had anything. I enjoy some wine or a couple drinks, but I don't do any drugs at all and haven't since 71. And Paul and Pat are the same. Eric, pretty much the same too, I believe. And so we weren't, we enjoy a few drinks here and there, but it was not a wild party band. We were into hitting the mark, getting up on stage and doing the best we possibly could. So there wasn't really room for that kind of shenanigans.
Yeah, I don't think a band like Mr. Big could perform the way you guys do if you were on drugs or drinking.
Yeah, a couple times, like on New Year's Eve gig or something like that, I'll have a couple glasses and be on stage, and it was no way I can do this. I can't. We're gonna have to play all the jammy simple songs because I can't. No way I'm gonna be able to get through this night half in the bag.
Yeah, yeah. Was that difficult during the 80s? Because that was, you know, the heyday of all the partying and
Not for me. I'd be around people doing lines of coke and doing all kinds of stuff, but it just I never wanted to get involved in it.
Sure.
You know, I'd enjoy, having a beer, wine, maybe a sip of whiskey or a mixed drink, but, I just never got into the drug thing. And I saw a lot of it, especially in L.A. You see it was around, but I never had any inclination to go there. I just felt it would be. Well, one thing I did notice when I did smoke dope in high school, we played in Erie, Pennsylvania, and we brought along a reel-to-reel tape recorder. It was like 71. So we recorded the night, and we went off behind the building. We all toked up on some marijuana, and we played, and we're looking at each other like, thank God we brought this tape recorder. This is amazing. We're jamming. It's so great. We're having a riot. We couldn't wait to get up the next morning and play that tape. And as you could probably guess, we're thinking. It was awful. So that was another contributing factor to my decision.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about your bass playing when you approach a song, because you have you seem to be able to balance the melodic part of it with the technical part of it, where it's not overwhelming too technical, if that makes sense. How do you look at that? Because some players, a lot of guitar players that can play that way just go overboard sometimes, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I just heard a couple tracks somebody sent me, and the guitar player was way over the top. And it was out of context. But I think the thing that really helped me understand what's necessary is I learned a million songs. When I was young, we played copy tunes. We played 3 and 4 sets a night. We did 3 shows in one day once. We did 21 nights in a row one time, where you're up and you're singing and playing every night and playing songs that are hits. So you get used to, what do you do when you play a hit? What does a hit require? So it just kind of builds into you a kind of an instinct of what to do. And it isn't automatically to do something at all. It's just there it is. There's that note at that time. So I a lot of guys look down at copy bands. Most every band that's successful was a copy band at one point or another. Almost everybody, AC/DC guys. I got Bon Scott singing love songs. I got Ronnie James Dio singing "To Know You Is to Love You," and "I Left My Heart in San Francisco" in a lounge band. Everybody played in copy bands, and you learned. That's where you really learned, and the song craftsmanship of bands that played in copy bands seemed superior to me. The Beatles, arguably the best writing band ever, and they're. I've got the original demo of about 20 songs, not one original. They were all copy tunes. And so coming up like that, I'm thankful. A lot of guys feel like they're hitting their head against the wall and they get frustrated, but I'm thankful to have played so many songs by such great artists and get a feel for what it was like to play that song. And not that I had the delusion that I had anything to do with it, but by playing it, you kind of feel that way. And there was an interesting look at art and how artists copy, and artists copy from those, the great ones that came before them. Before Bach was Telemann. Listen to them both; they're very, very similar. I don't know enough about the musicology of that, if that was the case, but. When you listen to a lot of great bands, you can hear kind of where it comes from, especially now because our history is so well illuminated. You can find I hear a chord change, you go, ah, that came from Spirit. We hear a hit song once in a while, go, ah, that chorus, I know where that's from. And somebody, I think it was Hunter S. Thompson, took a famous novel, was like War and Peace or something, or Little Women or some famous novel, sat down at a typewriter and copied the entire book by typing it out to get the feel of what it would be like to write a book like that. Architects as well. They design buildings similar to the great designs that they see other architects do to get a feel for what it's like. So it's no different in music. That you when you learn from copy tunes, you're really learning from the masters and songs that are hits, and they're hits for a reason. So your original question, as far as bass playing goes, that's how I approach it, is try to keep in mind the average listener and what they're going to think about it. Once in a while, you need a little thing in there to maybe to, oh, what was that? But a lot of times you don't. And to be with you, I love playing bass on that. I play it every show, and it's the simplest. I got a little McCartney on it when in the pre-chorus. Wait, how is it? Was from just before he sings in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I don't really want to stop the show, but I thought you might like to know McCartney plays exactly that line. And I lifted it right off Sir Paul. I apologize, sir. And just wove a little Beatles-esque right into To Be With You. I don't know if anyone's noticed that or if it's noticeable enough. But for me, having listened to Sgt. Pepper's 1,000 times, that album, flip it over, listen, and such great songs, and it really left a mark on me. So it makes my bass playing, hopefully, cohesive and able to fit what's going on with the song.
Mm-hmm. As a bass player, you know, you always learn, you focus on those, connect with the drums, lock in on those drums. I find myself sometimes I like to have the vocals in there too, to weave around some of those vocals. Do you ever take that into consideration as well, or no?
Yeah, for me, it's 90% drums, maybe 80, but you're right. A vocal line. I know right now our guitarist Paul, with a slide, learned like all kinds of singing songs and learn the vocal line on slide. Just get used to that vocalization line, the way vocals are done. And there's lines are repeated often in a chorus. You're singing the same melody over a bunch of times and things like that. But singing for me is the entrance point for pretty much every band and almost every song. Even though I like a lot of instrumental music, a lot of classical music, that vocal is the key that opens the door to you listening to a song or falling in love with it. And so that's always been very important to me as well. But playing a note when that bass drum hits a hit, and maybe an octave above when the snare hits, I learned that before I even owned a bass, because there was a bass player in my neighborhood was just him and the drummer rehearsing. And I said, Joe, where's the rest of the band? He goes, no, I rehearsed with the drummer, so we know exactly what each other's doing. So I carried that around all the way up to present time. When we were rehearsing for this tour, I went up a day early to get together with Nick DiVirgilio and just go over all the songs, bass and drums. Let me see what you're doing. You see what I'm doing. Lock them together. Me and Pat Torpy would do that for hours before a tour. Just sit and go over every song, bass and drums, every song. And then that gave us a great foundation. So when the guitar player's in there, he feels like he's standing on, you know, 18 inches of concrete. Feels solid. And the vocalist has got free range to do his thing because he's got the solid thing underneath them with his bass and drums.
Man, so I'd love to hear that stuff. You ever record it?
Yeah, we did a recording of bass and drums for I think one of Pat's instructional videos. And we just did a rock and roll over and one other, but it's just bass and drums. And it was a riot. And it came out really, really well.
I bet.
It's probably on YouTube somewhere, but
I'll have to look that up. You know, one of the songs off your first record, Blame It On My Youth, I thought was a very interesting bass line, because if you listen to that, you're barely playing in the verse. And then when it comes into the pre-chorus, I think you're doing a bunch of harmonic stuff. And then it gets into the chorus with, it sounds like a bunch of chords. Is that what you're doing in there?
I think so. I've done a lot of chords on bass, because especially like just the root fifth octave.
Yeah.
Instead of ending the song with a, why not hit every two E's and two B's and end like that with the open E. So I've always kind of had a chordal thing that I would do with bass, especially in situations that might require it. You know, doing a little chord thing and double stop. And learning chords just helps me understand the real estate of the fretboard better as well, and the relationship of notes together. But do a big, fat, giant three-string chord at the ending of a song, or all hit everything at once. Just again, for lack of other person, I also play bass pedals, and I've had them since the 70s. And so I hit one giant, big, fat, two octave down low E note that'll shake the subwoofers at the end of a song. And like in Green Tinted 60s Mine, when we're playing the solo section, I'm playing the root notes on the pedals. And so when I get into that, there's something underneath that, you know, there's that note there underneath it. So that comes in handy. Or when I'm using the drill and the Daddy Brother thing, you can't hear the low end of the bass at all. So I'll play that on pedals as well. On the song I mentioned earlier, Promise Her the Moon, there's a little flute melody in it. And I'll do a flute patch and do that flute on the pedals. Mm-hmm. So they're really handy. Cool. And I use them a lot.
Yeah. Tell me about what's the status on Winery Dogs? What's going on with Winery Dogs?
When Mike finishes his run with Dream Theater, we're going to go back and do some more. That's
okay.
That's what's happening.
Just on hold right now.
Yeah. I love that band. I love playing that band.
Great band. You always seem to surround yourself with the perfect fit, best musicians.
Well, I'm very lucky to play with some great guys, especially drummers. I'm just got done describing, but I had an opportunity to play with Dennis Chambers for a bunch of records with Niacin, and whew, man, I learned a lot from him. It's just really a great beginning, just the way he takes time, because I was basically straight rock 2/4. So I played, you know, some progressive-y time signature things, but Dennis just has this flow to him and this groove in this pocket that is just amazing. It kind of grabs you by the throat and you have no choice but to lock in with him. He's amazing. And of course, Mike and Winery Dogs and Mark Miller and Talis. Man, what a mind-blowing drummer. Man, he's first time I ever heard him. I said, I got to play with that guy. And fortunately, I ended up doing it. And what an amazing
talent on drums. Incredible.
Do you ever get up there with any drummers and you're like, I can't do this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did well, it's somewhat related. We did I'll do the rock and roll fantasy camps once in a while. It was me, I think Phil Sasson and Rudy Sarzo. And we were given the task to go listen to all the drummers and choose which ones would be the best ones, whatever. And they're the campers, they're just the participants. Some can drum pretty good, some can't at all. And you have to coach them through it. And that's the point of the camp. You know, you get, use a lot of emotions, but you get on stage eventually. And so we've been doing it for a while, and they had a kit set up, and one guy come in, and we tried to give him the best advice we could. And next one, next one, next one. I turned my back to the drum kit, and I didn't see Vinny Appice sit down. All he did was take one stick and hit the snare drum. Pop! And I spun around, like, instantly I knew that there was a drummer at the kit. One
just from the hit.
One snare hit. Pop! Vinny, I didn't even know you were here.
You're like, that's my guy.
It taught me a great lesson. I mean, you don't even really need to do much. A single note, and this is the command that a drummer has, or can have, just with the command of the six and the way they just hit those heads. It's quite amazing. A normal person wouldn't think that. I got a stick and a drum, I hit it, how could it be different? Yeah. It is, really is.
Well, it kind of works the same way with bass and guitar too. You know, the attack absolutely. That player has on there, you absolutely. Can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear things. And I remember back in the day when it was Beck, Clapton, and Page. People that couldn't tell the difference, I thought, how could you not tell the difference? But we, as musicians, we forget, you know, that there's the little nuances we listen to in here and are playing to us. They may not be that so in that way for the casual listener. You know?
Yeah, yeah. How about slap bass? I don't hear you playing much slap. Are you a big slap guy or no?
No. When it first came out, what was happening was disco was coming in, and they would, a lot of clubs rip the stage out, put in a dance floor, a mirror ball, and a DJ, and we were out of a gig. And so it was kind of traumatic to hear that, because I'm like, wait, are they shutting this club down too? And so I never got into it much until after the first wave of it kind of went away. And then I thought, let me inspect it a little bit more. It's still not my thing, but I do... You know, I do it. I've done it when I've had to do sessions and do a little slap thingy. Steve Vai had a song that had an up and down octave thing that the bass player who recorded it on his record did that I had to do. And it's fun to do and it's cool, but it's just and tonally my amp isn't really set up for slap. It's meant for that big giant single note or a cascade of a lot of other notes. So it doesn't quite work as well. But I like it, and I'm glad that there are so many variations on a theme of how you can play one instrument. I'm sure it's like that with everything, but with all instruments, but for bass for certain now. Two different worlds. And sometimes they do it together.
Looking back on everything, your portfolio of everything you've done, do you feel you've accomplished everything you've wanted to, or is there still some things left that you want to do?
It's been great. I would like more, of course. Who wouldn't? But I'm supremely grateful that I've had any success at all. And that I played with some amazing people, wonderful people, and been a part of some great, great, great records. So, yeah, it's certainly plenty. But, there's not much that I really feel like I missed out on or that I never could do that I wanted to do. It's pretty cool. I played with and met with the other day. There was a post on Facebook that reminded me we were in Japan with Mr. Big doing a show, and our singer knocks on the door and goes, hey, somebody here wants to talk to you. And that's a little pissed off. I'm like, I'm warming up. I'm like, who is it? He goes, Robert Fripp. And he opens the door, and there he is. And so, oh my God, I was a huge Crimson fan. I really, arguably the beginning of all progressive rock. And so we talked for a while, and he wanted to watch the show, but he didn't want to go out in the audience because people would be, he's kind of keeps himself a little bit. So we gave him a chair right on the side of the stage, a proscenium stage. So as I'm playing, there's Robert Fripp 10 feet from me. And he was laughing, and we had a riot. And as I was playing, I'm thinking, oh, that came from King Crimson. Oh, there's another thing. Then we went out afterwards and had a drink at the hotel. And we just had the greatest time. And he just posted the other day about that, how much fun it was for him to watch a Mr. Big show. And a lot of people were shocked, like, what? Robert Fripp watching Mr. Big? But and I think that's why he's such a great musician, because he opens his ears to everything, you know, and he doesn't dismiss something because of some extraneous thing. Who knows? But things like that really along the way have made it just so an incredible journey, you know, to know someone like that. It was just such a hero of mine. It's just a wonderful, amazing person. And to be an acquaintance of his is, that's unbelievable, you know. So, and a lot of people like that too, I've been lucky enough to meet and hang with. And it's been a great run. And I'm still practicing as much or more than ever here in my hotel room. This never gets left behind. And coming up with a lot of new things. And one great thing about being on tour is that during the day, you got some time to yourself to warm up and can try new things and new ways and new patterns and new approaches to things. And it's really a great time for me to be out on tour, and me and my bass out on tour. And then you get to play at night and try some of it out, or just play to an amazing audience. It's been pretty cool.
Well, that's awesome, Billy. I mean, you're a legend.
You're very kind to say.
Yes, yeah. Great career you've had, that you're having. You're not done.
No. I got a bunch during the pandemic. Out of nowhere, people would just email me and say, "Hey, I got a song. Can you play bass on it?" And I go, "Yeah." How much? And I'd give them a reasonable price, not a sure. pretty low price, really. Then after a while, though, I had to raise the price up on the more complicated songs. So if somebody sent me some prog orchestrated impossible. Because I can't read, and I gotta learn it and memorize it. So I said that charge. I gotta charge you. So I started the rule. I gotta hear it first before I say yes, and then how much it's gonna be. But I was always trying to be reasonable, because they're non-professionals. I don't have a lot of money, so I do the best price I can do. Pay my engineer, keep him employed as well. But we did like hundreds of tracks from people all over the world. And whole albums, and some oddball, strange stuff, and some pretty cool stuff as well.
That's got to be fun to get to see it all, though, you know, and play all these different things for people.
One thing that became really clear, we'd get the stems or a version of the song to record too. Sometimes I would record just to the MP3 on a separate track. Me and my engineer look at each other like, oh man, what are we gonna do here? Especially if there's no guide track, it's just make it up. Oh boy. So we'd get to work and figure something out. By the end, we'd listen again and go, I get it now. It makes perfect sense. And I'm not talking about because it's my playing or me, it's just bass in general. When you can take a bass and really alter the fabric of a song by doing the right thing at the right time. And I feel we did that a lot with a lot of these tracks. And I don't think anyone was dissatisfied. We could just get glowing responses when we sent it to them. And we really did try to do our best for them and do, you know, sometimes we do two takes, one wild and one not, so they can cut what the wild parts in that they wanted or throw them out. But it was a great illustration of what the bass does in the body of a song that you hear. Hearing it without it at all in first, and that's the key point. And then hearing it added in, see where it goes to later. It was quite fascinating.
Are you a digital guy in the studio, or do you mic up the amp still?
I have my entire analog rack, which we go direct with, but there's no mics in front of speakers.
Okay.
I also have the Helix, which I use on some tracks as well. But my original old Pierce preamp, which is modeled in the Helix, my old Ashley Audio compressors, all the original gear I used for years since the late 70s is all right there and still sounds great. It works out really well. I can reproduce most of that with the Helix live and if I need to in a studio. Mm-hmm. The other day I did a session and I just took my little EBS pedal because it gave me a little bit of dirt distortion on the bass. You can dial in as much of it as you want or out, in or out. So I did a whole session with just that. It worked out okay. But generally I'll use my analog rack and or the Helix. And we can get things to sound really, really nice. We were pleased and the clients were pleased. So that was a good thing.
Awesome. All right, Billy. Well, listen, I'm not going to keep you on too much longer. I know you had a long travel day. It's been an honor to chat with you. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And let me know when you get a link to this and I'll share it around.
I will. I'll email you.
Thanks, Billy. All right. You take care.